It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob
Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Sorry, Gene. Coming up later in the program, we'll look at a new report that suggests that Wisconsin is lagging when it comes to the quality of teacher training programs.
But first, the United Nations named 2013 the International Year of Quinoa, and not without reason. Quinoa is often found in health food stores, and world health experts praise it as a possible low-cost solution to global hunger.
However, its so-called superfood properties have ignited controversy, especially in its native regions like Bolivia and Ecuador. In Bolivia, it has spurred a fight between producers who vie for the rights to produce it.
And internationally, world health officials are furious at Bolivia's refusal to share the seeds from their gene banks so it could be produced locally.
With us to tell the story of quinoa is writer and photographer Lisa Hamilton. Her article, The Quinoa Quarrel, appeared in the May issue of Harper's Magazine. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we've seen, and you write, that there are high hopes for quinoa, not just as kind of a superfood for Whole Foods customers, but as a, maybe a staple, a savior for poor communities around the world. Why are there high hopes around quinoa?
Well, as you probably know, it has this extraordinary nutritional profile, calcium, iron, essential fatty acids, and so on. It's also, most importantly, the only plant in the world to offer a complete protein, which puts it essentially on par with milk and eggs. So it's this incredible opportunity to deliver vegetarian nutrition around the world with fewer resources than providing animal protein requires. The plant is also incredibly resilient. It can handle drought, it can handle cold, it can even handle salty soils. So there are a growing number of people who see it as this potential tool in solving one of the big conundrums that we're facing with climate change, which is how are we going to feed the world's growing population in a world that's increasingly challenging for agriculture.
Quinoa is new to us. It's not new to people in Bolivia and in other nearby countries. What does quinoa mean to Bolivian culture?
When I think about quinoa in Bolivia, I think about the trip that I made there to write this article. And I was speaking with a quinoa farmer in the Altiplano, in the southern Altiplano, the southern part of Bolivia, sort of the heart of the quinoa growing region. And I asked him if I could interview him about quinoa and the sort of conflicts that are happening around it. And he said, absolutely. He said, but in order to do so, I'd like to climb to the top of the nearby volcano, which was sort of looming above us at the time. And so on Easter Sunday, we climbed about 3,000 feet in elevation, already starting out at about 12,000 feet, went up to 15,000 feet elevation to the top of this volcano. And it was a pretty arduous climb. But when we got up there, he looked at me and he explained that this volcano, in fact, was a god named Tunupa. And it was this god who gave the Bolivian people quinoa, according to their indigenous legends. He said, quinoa is the origin of life. This volcano is the origin of life, and it's giving us quinoa is the origin. Our conversation, we talked about international regulations and treaties and patents and so on, but really he was putting in the context of 10,000 years of indigenous history here in Bolivia.
How has a rising interest in quinoa elsewhere in the world affected the people who grow and eat it there in Bolivia?
Well, certainly there have been a lot of news stories over the past couple of years about rising prices of quinoa and how that might be making it inaccessible for the people who actually live in Bolivia and grow it, that this nutritional boon is no longer available to them. That's a complicated story, and it really depends where exactly you're talking about. But what I was writing about this in this article is slightly separate, which is the impact of intellectual property laws, patents on plants and all of the restrictions that come with them. When you apply it to a plant like quinoa, again, there are a growing number of researchers around the world who think that this could be an extraordinary tool for people in marginal lands in rural areas around the world who are struggling to feed themselves because it's such a resilient plant. The challenge is that quinoa, you can't just take quinoa from Bolivia and grow it in, say, Malawi or Pakistan or Iowa or California. The plant really needs to be bred down from this Andean environment, which, as I said, begins at about 12,000 feet in elevation and has a completely different climate. In order to breed the plant down to these different locations at sea level around the world, you need access to the seeds, essentially, to the genetic diversity that's contained in those seeds. Well, because this has, until really the past 30 years, been exclusively an indigenous crop of the Andes, those seeds, that genetic diversity, are held almost entirely by the Andean nations, Ecuador, Peru, and Bolivia, largely. And Bolivia holds the most among them, about 3,000 different varieties of quinoa. Because of the legacy of intellectual property rights in plants, which people in Wisconsin will be familiar with in corn, but really have impacted food crops of all kinds around the world, because of that legacy, the Bolivian people are not interested in sharing their seed in order to allow the plant to be bred down to sea level and to travel throughout the world. So it's a complicated situation. And in reporting this article, I was consistently struck by the fact that there really are no heroes and no villains. There are just very different world views, seeing sort of food security as a global issue and seeing food security as a local issue. And this is where those two views butt up against each other.
Well, from the point of view of the Bolivian people, say, and the Bolivian government, what do they worry about if they release those seeds and all that genetic information to the rest of the world? What is the downside from their perspective?
Well, you know, I think there are a few different angles on it. Certainly, quinoa's popularity in recent years has offered the people of the Altiplano, which is traditionally a very poor area, one of the poorest places in the Western Hemisphere. It suddenly has this economic opportunity in quinoa, holding on to the seeds, the germplasm of quinoa, allows them, you know, to hold on to that economic opportunity because other people aren't able to grow it on a really significant commercial scale. But that's not the entire story. Certainly they are worried about intellectual property. In the 1990s, there was a group of researchers from Colorado State University that came up with a novel quinoa before there were restrictions on sharing germplasm, and they applied for a patent on it. And that was seen as a threat, not just to economic opportunity in Bolivia, but really as a threat to the culture. In a lot of ways, this plant holds a place for many indigenous Bolivians that Americans can have a hard time understanding. It is both a food and a business. It's also a very potent spiritual force. In a lot of ways, it holds the place of a god of sorts. And so for then intellectual property restrictions to be placed on that plant, it simply doesn't compute.
Yeah, I think you write something also, you write something to the effect of, say, if I patented a version of quinoa, it would be something like an atheist patenting a version of the Bible.
Exactly. It doesn't compute, but what's more, it is a deep, deep offense and really a threat to livelihood and tradition all at once. So So the Bolivians have a very strong and complex case for not sharing their seed. At the same time, there are voices from outside of Bolivia, including the researchers from Brigham Young University in Utah, who are some of the leading voices in sort of globalizing quinoa for humanitarian purposes. These voices are saying this is too precious a resource to be held by any one group of people. These plants belong not to Bolivians or Peruvians, they belong to the world. And furthermore, there are those who make a case that by isolating the seeds, by not sharing that genetic diversity, the people who care about it most, the Bolivians, are in fact putting their seeds at risk of being lost and their own crops of being threatened by that genetic isolation.
On a bigger picture, what does the story of quinoa tell us about the idea of patenting plant genetic materials?
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly it tells us that this is going to be an issue that gets bigger and bigger as we move forward into this uncertain future of climate change and all of the challenges that it brings for agriculture at a time when the world population is growing rapidly. It's going to be a significant issue. It hasn't gone away. It's an interesting thing. Intellectual property rights, when applied to plants, it sort of can't coexist with free exchange, which is what existed for, you know, the tens of thousands of years prior to the 20th century when intellectual property rights came into being with regard to plants. That free exchange is sort of trumped by intellectual property rights. Once someone owns some seed, suddenly everyone has to own their seed lest someone else come along and say it's theirs. But this was an issue, actually, that I wrote about recently in a totally different context about a group of plant breeders around the country, several of them actually based at University of Wisconsin-Madison, who were coming up with what they hoped might be a sort of antidote to this intellectual property rights empire that's happening, creating open source seed on the model of computer hackers making open source software. It's something that people all over the world, from Bolivia to Wisconsin, are struggling to deal with, recognizing that genetic diversity is the foundation of adapting plants to new conditions, like those we're facing with climate change and dwindling natural resources that are happening all around us. And yet that genetic diversity that we need so badly is threatened by the isolation that's created by intellectual property rights.
It's a story to keep watching. That's all the time we have. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was writer and photographer Lisa Hamilton. Her article, The Quinoa Quarrel, was produced in conjunction with the Food and Environment Reporting Network and appeared in Harper's Magazine.
A new report out this week is ruffling some feathers in the state's education community. The 2014 Teacher Prep Review looked at how schools across the country prepare teachers for a future in education and found that Wisconsin and some other states could use some improvement.
No program in the state earned the group's top-ranked status, which is awarded for overall strong performance when it comes to training teachers, and that's generated some discussion here in Wisconsin's education community.
Here to talk about the results of the report is Kate Walsh. She is the president of the National Council on Teacher Quality, the group that issued the report. And Kate, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to start out with a little bit of background on the council itself, because I suspect a lot of people haven't heard of it before this report came out. Now, in the FAQ section on your website there, it says the NCTQ is committed to restructuring the teaching profession, and it formed back in 2000. What have you been up to since then?
Well, basically, the problem is that the teaching profession is in very poor health. There are many wonderful teachers in the classroom, but this is not our focus. Our focus is on the policies that have so much of an impact on teachers. So we look at what states are doing, what higher ed's doing, what unions and districts are doing, all of which their actions of those institutions every day have everyday impact on teachers in the classroom.
And in this case, specifically, teacher training is what we're talking about. So tell me a little bit about the survey, the report. As I understand it, this was the second year for it.
Yeah, this is a pretty massive effort because there are so many institutions in the United States which train teachers. There are actually 1,450. It's interesting, you can compare that to China, where there are only 189, and they're four times bigger than we are. So we have a lot of schools of education, and some of them produce only a couple teachers a year. Some of them produce hundreds and hundreds of teachers a year. So it's a huge market, and no one has ever come up with a way to distinguish one program from another. So teachers make decisions about where to go for their preparation, and they really have no information on which to go by.
So given that, how did you set about trying to do this? How did the survey work?
We wanted to see what programs thought was important. So what are they teaching? And what happens to teachers to get them ready for the classroom? Our whole focus is on what teachers need to walk into a classroom on that first day of school and be competent. Not be superstars, but just be competent. And so our lens is very much on what public schools say their new teachers lack. We're looking at all the various things that new teachers aren't getting that they should be getting. So we start with raw talent. Are programs sufficiently selective? You know, it's fascinating that in the United States we have sort of an open-door policy to getting into teaching, which is such a demanding job, requires intellectual rigor, and yet we have a policy in place that basically says if you want to teach, if you love kids, you belong in the profession. And that's just not true. You need to love kids, but you also need to have some academic ability. And then on top of that, we then start looking at the content preparation. What are the courses they take? We look at the practice they're getting. We look at the quality of the student teaching experience. And we also try to look at their outcomes, though we haven't been as successful getting a hold of what these outcomes are from programs.
And so one of the criticisms of the survey is that you haven't had the ability to get into the classroom, to get inside the programs, really, to look at how the students are interacting with professors and that sort of thing. And it's sort of a paper survey. How do you respond to those sorts of criticisms?
Well, we're looking at what's important about the program. So you don't need to go visit a program to figure out how selective they are. The mission standards are very clear. And then we're looking at what they require their students to read and what they tell school districts is important about their student teachers and what kind of classrooms they need to be assigned to. We're looking at all sorts of things about, like, the instrument that the student teachers are used to evaluate the student teachers. So we think we're looking at very important things that any consumer, any aspiring teacher would want to know. For example, if you're going to go into a program, wouldn't you want to know if they're going to teach you how to teach reading? Nothing's more basic, but a lot of programs aren't doing it.
We've only got about a minute left before the break, and then we'll be coming back. But as it turns out, Wisconsin did not do particularly well in the survey this year.
I would put Wisconsin in the bottom quartile of states. And that's not to say that there aren't many, many fine teachers who are graduating from institutions in Wisconsin. I'm sure there are superstars coming out of many programs. What our take is to look and see whether a program is adding value. Are you going to be a better teacher than you would have been otherwise for having gone through various programs? And we're seeing very little value added from these programs.
We're talking with the president of the National Council on Teacher Quality, Kate Walsh. Her group's new report suggests that teacher training programs in Wisconsin are lagging well behind those in the other parts of the country. And you can join in the discussion if you'd like at 800-642-1234.
If you're a teacher or training to become one, what do you make of this news? Or if you work in one of the state's teacher training programs, what do you think about this? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Kate Walsh, the president of the National Council on Teacher Quality. Her group has released a new report, the 2014 Teacher Prep Review, and among other things, it indicates that Wisconsin's teacher training programs could be improved a fair amount. You can join the conversation if you'd like at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. If you're in one of those programs right now, or if you've recently graduated, how do you feel the program served you? Are there changes that you would like to see instituted that could help make you a better educator? And are you wondering where your program is ranked? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can also post comments on the Central Time Facebook page. Kate Walsh, before we get to phone calls, one of the things I'd like to point out is that in Wisconsin, not all the schools chose to participate in the survey. Why do you suppose that is?
This has not been this is work that's not been embraced, shall we say, by higher ed. They have not been particularly interested in having this information public. We're only trying to collect information that every student who is in a program has access to, but nevertheless, it's something that higher ed has not been interested in sharing.
Do you see that changing at all? Or has it been pretty much a constant since you've begun your work?
Oh, well, definitely I'm spending less money on lawyers these days to try to get folks to comply with the law. We had to put in open records requests with institutions last year, and we're finding that this year there's been a growing number of institutions which have come to us privately, at least, to admit that that this is causing them to reexamine how it is they're preparing teachers.
Well, let's go to the phones right now. We've got some listeners who would like to join in, and we begin in Milwaukee with Patty. Hi, Patty.
Hi. I graduated from UWM in education in 1978, and I was in the classroom for a few years full-time, but then did a lot of substitute teaching in the meantime. And even back then, I mean, this is certainly not a new issue. I was absolutely shocked as a young teacher how unprepared I was for classroom management and other things. And it just seems to me that it would make sense for a teacher. I mean, my student teaching experience was great, but I needed another year to have like a fellowship or an internship where I observed teachers and I worked with other teachers to perfect what is really an incredible talent, really, to be a teacher. And I never got that. They just throw these young people in the classroom with no help.
Patty, thanks so much for the call, and thanks so much for the insights. Kate Walsh, 1978, was a long time ago. Have there been changes since then?
No, if anything, it's gotten worse, I would say. You know, teachers really complain a lot about the lack of training they get in classroom management or how to teach reading. And people think it's just because schools of education are spending too much time on theory. The answer is a little bit more complicated than that. Really, schools of ed decided in the 1970s that it was not their job to train teachers. And if you're scratching your head, it's what I did when I realized that. But they've become very clear about this. They say that that is not what they're supposed to do. So as a result, teachers like your recent caller aren't getting what they need in by way of practical training.
Well, what are they getting then? I mean, they're spending 3-4 years in college, allegedly getting a degree in education, right?
Well, when you ask folks in teacher education what it is they think they should be doing, they believe that their job is to create a professional identity of the aspiring teacher. That's not altogether clear to me what that means, but it does mean that they think that they can prepare someone to make really good decisions on their own, and that it would bias them to give them a lot of information that they might take out of context. So not the idea is not to train, and I know this is hard to understand, so if you're feeling a little bit confused, it's understandable. But if the idea is not to train, the idea is to mold the new teacher.
Let's head back to the phones right now, and Lynn joins us from Green Bay. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. I've got a question about outcomes, because your organization ranks teacher training so low in Wisconsin, and Wisconsin ranks second in our ACT scores, and we have a higher literacy rate than the rest of the country at 93%, compared to the U.S. as a whole at 86%. So if we're doing such a horrible job in, you know, the bottom 25%, the outcomes don't correlate with what's happening in the classroom. So certainly there's always room for improvement. And I'm also interested in where you get your funding from.
All right, two questions there, Lynn. Thanks for the call. Kate Walsh, let's start with the conundrum first. Why are the outcomes so good in Wisconsin if the teacher training is not?
Well, that's a fabulous question, and it goes back to what I started with when we started our conversation. We're not saying that there aren't many great teachers who come out of these programs. What we're saying is that these programs are not adding value. They're not helping the teacher get ready for that first year in the classroom. So teachers are having to learn on their own or from other colleagues on how to be a good teacher. So that's part of the reason why explains why Wisconsin does so well. The other reason that Wisconsin continues to do so well is that it has a much less challenging population than most states do in the United States. So schools can perform at a very high level because they are relative to other states. It's a less challenging population with less poverty. So you always have to factor that into any frame of how you look at this problem. And then lastly, as for our funding, we get a lot of funding from all over the country, all from private philanthropists. So for this project, we had well over 70 funders, including a couple located in Wisconsin, with an average grant size of $25,000.
Let's go into Jessica right now, and Jessica joins us from Milwaukee.
Hi, I used to be a teacher for a couple years in Milwaukee, and something that I wish I knew going into teaching were some of the policies and laws that protected me as a teacher and also protected my fellow teachers, because I was in a lot of questionable circumstances that I kind of had to figure out on my own what I was going to do. And I listened to my principal sometimes, and oftentimes I, you know, put myself in very questionable situations because I didn't know what was right and what was wrong as far as the legal aspect goes. And now that I'm done with teaching, I'm reflecting on my experience and thinking, you know, I mean, the million different ways what I should have done. And I have horror stories from my experience because I didn't know what was right and wrong at the time. And I felt like I got taken advantage of as a new teacher for not knowing.
Jessica, thank you for the call. And Kate Walsh, is that the sort of practical thing that you think is lacking in teacher training these days?
That isn't actually an area that we looked at as much as do teachers know how to manage a classroom of student behavior. So do new teachers get the instruction they need to minimize the kind of behavior problems which your caller was alluding to, and how to keep kids from, how to keep behavior problems from escalating? And while every program tells us they teach classroom management, what we learned was when you dig down, you see very little evidence that the actual strategies that are research-based are taught in these programs. But more importantly than just being taught, they're not practiced either. So So we looked at the instruments that are used to evaluate student teachers. And we said, is there any evidence that the program is expecting a student teacher to know the importance of applying positive reinforcement so kids don't try to get attention through negative ways? I mean, that's something parents all learn about, right? Unfortunately, I learned about it way too late in my own children's childhood, but I wish someone had told me that when I was in a hospital with my new babies, the importance of positive reinforcement. Well, the same goes for teachers. They need to not only know the importance of positive reinforcement, they also need to practice it in really difficult situations when they want to be yelling and they can't.
Let's take one more call. We've got time for Jane, who joins us from Menominee. Hi.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. My question is, what does your guest think of these programs that take professionals? They take a scientist that's working in a lab and say that they can teach science, or an accountant can come in and teach math, and they have not gotten any kind of teacher education. And I know there's programs out there. I don't know if they're on the federal or state level, but they certainly are putting and pushing for that kind of program, and I do have a teaching degree. I decided not to teach. I found out that's not for me. But classroom management was not my problem. So I just wondered what she felt about programs that just take professionals without any teaching skills and strategies to go into the classroom.
Well, let's ask her. Kate Walsh, what do you think about that? Are we talking about like adjunct faculty, that sort of thing?
No, we're talking about alternative certification, I believe.
Like Teach for America, that kind of thing?
Teach for America, the New Teacher Project. So in this year's review, we started looking at those programs. And what was interesting to us is that they actually performed worse than the traditional programs. We looked at their admission standards and whether or not the teachers know what they're going to teach and also what kind of support they're getting. And we saw pretty low performance across the board. There were some programs like Teach for America in Massachusetts, not in every state, because we looked at each program individually. But we did find some programs that did a pretty good job of not abandoning the teacher in the classroom without any sort of preparation and really making sure they got a lot of support. But for the most part, your caller is right. A lot of the alternative certification programs are not doing what they need to do to keep to support the new teacher.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but Kate, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure.
We've been talking with Kate Walsh, the president of the National Council on Teacher Quality. Her group has just issued a report which looks at the quality of teacher training programs across the nation. Coming up in just a moment, we'll find out why a popular specialized Wisconsin license plate is being retired from the road.
First, time for Wisconsin Life. For 9 days, 160 local and national artists paint Cedarburg during the town's annual plein air event. It's the state's largest gathering of artists. Producer Nancy Camden went to discover the appeal of painting outdoors.
3 or 4 hours goes by and I hardly think I've been painting a minute. It's a meditation and something that I really love to do. My name is Paul Bergquist. I'm from a little town in southwest Wisconsin, Viroqua. This is in Cedarburg, and I'm here for a plein air painting competition. You have to paint outside from life. It's a great little town, very picturesque. Plein air painting, if you're in the woods or if you're out in a field, you know, there's the usual things to watch out for, like bugs and animals. Try not to get into a field with a bull. I painted in the rain, painted in the snow. Painting in the rain, if it's a full-on downpour, I like to get under something and then paint out looking at the rain and painting a watery scene. Winter painting is a challenge, but you get some really great pictures in the winter. The particular painting that I'm working on right now is looks like an old stone stable, actually. And there's a great big old, I think maybe that's an elm tree, right at the edge, and there's a little dirt path winding its way back in there. There's some really hard shadows of the sun coming across the roof, and so I'm playing with those a little bit. And right now I'm battling with the sky, trying to get the right value of the colors there.
My name is Julie Jansen. I was born in Beaver Dam, Wisconsin, and grew up in Watertown. When I was in the sixth grade, the next door neighbor gave me his old set of oil paints. And so I started painting nature and horses, and that's when I began painting. Photographs do not give you the feeling of the scene. It's being on location and in the scene that helps to develop composition and color. You just don't get that from photographs. If you stand close to me, you'll hear me talking to myself. What colors need to be changed? The shape, make this color warmer. Wisconsin is excellent territory for painters. One thing so beautiful about Wisconsin is the diversity of its nature. Wetlands.
Little ponds.
Hilly areas.
Flowers.
Parks.
Picturesque old towns, old mills.
Bluffs.
Beautiful views.
Wild areas. I think growing up in Wisconsin is part of your soul, is part of my soul. When I think of Wisconsin, I think of all the beautiful places. That is what inspires me and inspires my work.
It's a great little town, very picturesque. It's great for painting.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. The series is a collaborative project from Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Find more info at wisconsinlife.org.
In 1998, Wisconsin celebrated 150 years of being a state, and while our sesquicentennial was observed in plenty of ways, many of us will remember the commemorative license plates issued for the occasion. Those license plates featured a tranquil Wisconsin landscape with red text, and they were a favorite for many Wisconsin drivers.
But after more than 15 years, the plates are being taken off the road and phased out. While they had a good run, some drivers do seem a little reluctant to give them up.
Here to talk more about what's going on with these license plates is Mitchell Warren, the director of the Bureau of Vehicle Services and the Division of Motor Vehicles at the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. Mitchell, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks, Gina, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's so long for the sesquicentennial plates. Mitch, could you give us a little bit of history about the license plates themselves?
Sure. I think you've actually recounted it pretty well. Through an act of the legislature back in 96, this limited edition plate series was created to commemorate the 150th birthday of Wisconsin. And the way the legislature created the law, the plates began issuance in December of 96, and then sunsetted that issuance 2 years later in December of 98. And during that two-year period, we issued about 440,000 sets of those plates.
Wow. I mean, I remember the sesquicentennial being a pretty big deal, but 440,000 of those, that sounds like it was a pretty popular option.
Unprecedented popularity for our special plates, for sure.
Well, now I have to say I still see some of those plates around the state now and again, and some of them I can read, and then some of them are like a white plate with a blotch of color on them, and I suspect that's why they're being phased out.
Yeah, certainly time and the wear and tear of being on the road on a daily basis, and in a state like Wisconsin where we truly have four seasons, they've really started to compromise the two things that are most important to us in a license plate, and that's the reflectivity of the plate and the legibility. And it was time. A lot of these plates have been on the road since original issuance back in the late 90s, and it's time to have something more modern on the road.
And at the same time, these are license plates that may have traveled with people not just miles and miles in Wisconsin, but from car to car to car as they've upgraded. And I suspect that a lot of people have a sentimental attachment to these old license plates.
Oh, absolutely. We've heard some of that, although I think there's also a pretty general acknowledgement out there that, you know, the sesquicentennial has been over for 16 years now, and you do see them on the road, and the vast majority you see are completely faded out and illegible. But there's no denying there's a strong connection with Wisconsinites and the motoring public here with these plates. They were pretty special.
So how does the DOT go about replacing license plates like these? Do you do this all at once? Is this a process that is phased in? And do we still have 440,000 of them out there, or are we somewhat less right now?
No, we have significantly less than the 440,000. At the same time we're replacing the sesquicentennial plates, We also have a few other just general issue red letter plates out there, and so we're taking the opportunity to replace those as well. And by the time we're done, which will be later this summer or early fall, we'll have replaced about 210,000 sets of those plates, so about less than half of where we were at original issuance. The way we do it, it happens at renewal. So when you receive your renewal notice in the mail, that notice will, rather than receiving the little postcard you normally receive, you'll receive a letter. It'll contain an explanation that you're going to be receiving some new license plates. And when you actually do the renewal, that's what triggers for us to actually mail you a new set of plates. So because plate renewals are done on an annual basis, this is a year-long process. We started last August. We'll wrap up this August, but we'll certainly have a few stragglers coming in. So by September, we should have the majority of the fleet updated.
And just to be clear on this, there are no exceptions, right? I mean, if I know somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody, I don't get to keep my sesquicentennial plates?
You're right. Maybe if one of you guys asked, but there's no exceptions.
Now, if we really want a specialized plate, we can't get the sesquicentennial one anymore, but there are others that we can take a look at.
Oh, we have numerous options in Wisconsin. We have over 75 different special group plates that are available to our motorists. For example, if you've served in the military or are a member of the military now, we've got over 56 different variants that you can display in your vehicle. We also have plates that celebrate and support the Green Bay Packers, the Milwaukee Brewers, the Endangered Species Fund, Ducks Unlimited, and there's a number of them.
And you can find a preview of all those on your website someplace, right?
You bet. www.wisconsindot.gov. Go to the DMV section. We have all of our plates displayed there. Some of these plates also support charities, so there's additional costs that go with those, but that money goes to specific charities.
And so finally, if I'm sitting at home and I've got a set of these plates in my car, I really don't have to do anything, right? I mean, it'll come as part of the notification, and I'll figure it all out at that time.
You got it. There is nothing for you to do. If you haven't received your renewal yet, you will. And there'll be instructions on there, along with a reminder that comes with your certificate of registration that comes in the mail, and then another reminder with the plates themselves when they arrive at your house. So there's nothing for you to do. And when you do put the new plates on your vehicle, you can recycle the old plates if you choose to. You can hang them on your garage wall. You do not need to return them to the DOT. You can dispose of them or keep them to cherish.
All right. Terrific. Mitchell, thanks so much for being here today. Mitchell Warren is Director of the Bureau of Vehicle Services and the Division of Motor Vehicles at the Wisconsin Department of Transportation.